after graduation. I solved my love worries by proposing to the girl that I feared might marry another cadet, and she is now Mrs. Jim Birdsall. As I look back at it now, I can see that my problem was one of confusion, a disinclination to find the causes of my worry and face them realistically. Jim Birdsall learned to stop worrying because he analyzed his troubles. In fact, he used the very principles described in the chapter, How to Analyze and Solve Worry Problems. I Have Lived by This Sentence, by Dr. Joseph R. Cizu, President, New Brunswick Theological Seminary, New Brunswick, New Jersey, the oldest theological seminary in the United States, founded in 1784. Years ago, in a day of uncertainty and disillusionment, when my whole life seemed to be overwhelmed by forces beyond my control, one morning, quite casually, I opened up my New Testament, and my eyes fell upon this sentence, He that sent me is with me. The Father hath not left me alone. My life has never been the same since that hour. Everything for me has been forever different after that. I suppose that not a day has passed that I have not repeated it to myself. Many have come to me for counseling during these years, and I have always sent them away with this sustaining sentence. Ever since that hour when my eyes fell upon it, I have lived by this sentence. I have walked with it, and I have found in it my peace and strength. To me, it is the very essence of religion. It lies at the rock bottom of everything that makes life worth living. It is the golden text of my life. I Hit Bottom and Survived, by Ted Erickson. I used to be a terrible worrywart. No more. In the summer of 1942, I had an experience that banished worry from my life for all time, I hope. The experience made every other trouble seem small by comparison. For years, I'd wanted to spend a summer on a commercial fishing craft in Alaska, so in 1942, I signed on a 32-foot salmon seining vessel out of Kodiak, Alaska. On a craft of this size, there's a crew of only three: the skipper, who does the supervision, a number two man who assists the skipper, and a general workhorse who's usually a Scandinavian. I'm a Scandinavian. Since salmon seining has to be done with the tides, I often work 20 hours out of 24. I kept up that schedule for a week at a time. I did everything that nobody else wanted to do. I washed the craft, I put away the gear, I cooked on a little wood-burning stove in a small cabin where the heat and fumes of the motor almost made me ill. I washed the dishes, I repaired the boat, I pitched the salmon from our boat into a tender that took the fish to a cannery. My feet were always wet in my rubber boots. My boots were often filled with water, but I had no time to empty them. But all that was play compared to my main job, which was pulling what's called the cork line. That operation simply means placing your feet on the stern of the craft and pulling in the corks and the webbing of the net. At least that's what you're supposed to do. But in reality, the net was so heavy that when I tried to pull it in, it wouldn't budge. What really happened was that in trying to pull in the cork line, I actually pulled in the boat. I pulled it along on my own power since the net stayed where it was. I did all this for weeks on end. It was almost the end of me, too. I ached horribly. I ached all over. I ached for months. When I finally did have the chance to rest, I slept on a damp, lumpy mattress piled on top of the provisions locker. I'd put one of these lumps in the mattress under the part of my back that hurt most and sleep as if I'd been drugged. I was drugged by complete exhaustion. I'm glad now that I had to endure all that aching and exhaustion, because it helped me stop worrying. Whenever I'm confronted by a problem now, instead of worrying about it, I say to myself, Erickson, could this possibly be as bad as pulling the cork line? And Erickson invariably answers, no, nothing could be that bad. So I cheer up and tackle it with courage. I believe it's a good thing to have to endure an agonizing experience occasionally. It's good to know that we've hit bottom and survived. That makes all our daily problems seem easy by comparison. I Used to Be One of the World's Biggest Jackasses, by Percy H. Whiting, author of The Five Great Rules of Selling. I've died more times from more different diseases than any other man, living, dead, or half-dead. I was no ordinary hypochondriac. My father owned a drugstore, and I was practically brought up in it. I talked to doctors and nurses every day, so I knew the names and symptoms of more and worse diseases than the average layman. I was no ordinary hypo. I had symptoms. I could worry for an hour or two over a disease and then have practically all the symptoms of a man who was suffering from it. I recall once that in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the town in which I lived, we had a rather severe diphtheria epidemic. In my father's drugstore, I'd been selling medicines day after day to people who came from infected homes. Then the evil that I feared came upon me. I had diphtheria myself. I was positive I had it. I went to bed and worried myself into the standard symptoms. I sent for a doctor. He looked me over and said, "Yes, Percy, you've got it," and that relieved my mind. I was never afraid of any disease when I had it, so I turned over and went to sleep. The next morning, I was in perfect health. For years, I distinguished myself and got a lot of attention and sympathy by specializing in unusual and fantastic diseases. I died several times of both lockjaw and hydrophobia. Later on, I settled down to having the run-of-the-mill ailments, specializing in cancer and tuberculosis. I can laugh about it now, but it was tragic then. I honestly and literally feared for years that I was walking on the edge of the grave. When it came time to buy a suit of clothes in the spring, I would ask myself, "Should I waste this money now when I know I can't possibly live to wear this suit out?" However, I'm happy to report progress. In the past 10 years, I haven't died even once. How did I stop dying? By kidding myself out of my ridiculous imaginings. Every time I felt the dreadful symptoms coming on, I laughed at myself and said, "See here, Whiting, you've been dying from one fatal disease after another now for 20 years, yet you're in first-class health today. An insurance company recently accepted you for more insurance. Isn't it about time, Whiting, that you stood aside and had a good laugh at the worrying jackass you are?" I soon found that I couldn't worry about myself and laugh at myself at one and the same time, so I've been laughing at myself ever since. Now, the point is this. Don't take yourself too seriously. Just try laughing at some of your sillier worries and see if you can't laugh them out of existence. I've Always Tried to Keep My Line of Supplies Open, by Gene Autry, the world's most famous and beloved singing cowboy. I figure that most worries are about family troubles and money. I was fortunate in marrying a small-town Oklahoma girl who had the same background I had and enjoyed the same things. We both try to follow the golden rule, so we've kept our family troubles to a minimum. I kept my financial worries to a minimum also by doing two things. First, I've always followed a rule of absolute 100% integrity in everything. When I borrowed money, I paid back every penny. Few things cause more worry than dishonesty. Second, when I started a new venture, I always kept an ace in the hole. Military experts say that the first principle of fighting a battle is to keep your line of supplies open. I figured that that principle applied to personal battles almost as much as to military battles. For example, as a lad down in Texas and Oklahoma, I saw some real poverty when the country was devastated by droughts. We had mighty hard scratching at times to make a living. We were so poor, my father used to drive across the country in a covered wagon with a string of horses and swap horses to make a living. I wanted something more reliable than that, so I got a job working for a railway station agent and learned telegraphy in my spare time. Later, I got a job working as a relief operator for the Frisco Railway. I was sent here, there, and yonder to relieve other station agents who were ill or on vacation or who had more work than they could do. Now, that job paid $150 per month. Later, when I started out to better myself, I always figured that that railroad job meant economic safety, so I always kept the road open back to that job. It was my line of supplies, and I never cut myself off from it until I was firmly established in a new and better position. For example, back in 1928, when I was working as a relief operator for the Frisco Railway in Chelsea, Oklahoma, a stranger drifted in one evening to send a telegram. He heard me playing the guitar and singing cowboy songs, and he told me I was good, told me that I ought to go to New York and get a job on the stage or radio. And naturally, I was flattered, and when I saw the name he signed to his telegram, I was almost breathless, Will Rogers. Instead of rushing off to New York at once, I thought the matter over carefully for 9 months. I finally came to the conclusion that I had nothing to lose and everything to gain by going to New York, giving the old town a whirl. I had a railroad pass. I could travel free. I could sleep sitting up in my seat, and I could carry some sandwiches and fruit for my meals. So I went. When I reached New York, I slept in a furnished room for $5 a week, ate at the automat, and tramped the streets for 10 weeks, and got nowhere. I would have been worried sick if I hadn't had a job to go back to. I'd already worked for the railway 5 years. That meant I had seniority rights. But in order to protect those rights, I couldn't lay off longer than 90 days. By this time, I'd already been in New York 70 days, so I rushed back to Oklahoma on my pass and began working again to protect my line of supply. I worked for a few months, saved money, and returned to New York for another try. This time, I got a break. One day, while waiting for an interview in the recording studio office, I played my guitar and sang a song to the girl receptionist, Janine, I Dream of Lilac Time. While I was singing that song, the man who wrote it, Nat Schildkraut, drifted into the office. Naturally, he was pleased to hear anyone singing his song, so he gave me a note of introduction and sent me down to the Victor Recording Company. I made a record. I was no good, too stiff and self-conscious. So I took the advice of the Victor recording man. I went back to Tulsa. I worked for the railway by day, and at night I sang cowboy songs on a sustaining radio program. I liked that arrangement. It meant that I was keeping my line of supplies open, so I had no worries. I sang for 9 months on the radio station KVOO in Tulsa. During that time, Jimmy Long and I wrote a song entitled That Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine. It caught on. Arthur Satterley, head of the American Recording Company, asked me to make a recording. It clicked. I made a number of other recordings for $50 each and finally got a job singing cowboy songs over radio station WLS in Chicago. Salary, $40 a week. After singing there 4 years, my salary was raised to $90 a week. I picked up another $300 doing personal appearances every night in theaters. Then in 1934, I got a break that opened up enormous possibilities. The League of Decency was formed to clean up the movies, so Hollywood producers decided to put on cowboy pictures, but they wanted a new kind of cowboy, one who could sing. The man who owned the American Recording Company was also part owner of Republic Pictures. If you want a singing cowboy, he said to his associates, I've got one making records for us. And that's how I broke into the movies. I started making singing cowboy pictures for $100 a week. I had serious doubts about whether I would succeed in pictures, but I didn't worry. I knew I could always go back to my old job. My success in pictures exceeded my wildest expectations. I now get a salary of $100,000 a year, plus one half of all the profits of my pictures. However, I realize this arrangement won't go on forever, but I'm not worried. I know that no matter what happens, even if I lose every dollar I have, I can always go back to Oklahoma and get a job working for the Frisco Railway. I have protected my line of supplies. I Heard a Voice in India by E. Stanley Jones, one of America's most dynamic speakers and the most famous missionary of his generation. I have devoted 40 years of my life to missionary work in India. At first, I found it difficult to endure the terrible heat, plus the nervous strain of the great task that stretched before me. At the end of 8 years, I was suffering so severely from brain fatigue and nervous exhaustion that I collapsed, not once but several times. I was ordered to take a year's furlough in America. On the boat returning to America, I collapsed again while speaking at a Sunday morning service on the ship, and the ship's doctor put me to bed for the remainder of the trip. After a year's rest in America, I started back to India, but stopped on the way to hold evangelistic meetings among the university students in Manila. In the midst of the strain of these meetings, I collapsed several times. Physicians warned me that if I returned to India, I would die. In spite of their warnings, I continued on to India, but I went with a deepening cloud upon me. When I arrived in Bombay, I was so broken that I went straight to the hills and rested for several months. Then I returned to the plains to continue my work. It was no use. I collapsed and was forced to return to the hills for another long rest. Again I descended to the plains, and again I was shocked and crushed to discover that I couldn't take it. I was exhausted mentally, nervously, and physically. I was completely at the end of my resources. I feared that I would be a physical wreck for the balance of my life. If I didn't get help from somewhere, I realized that I would have to give up my missionary career, go back to America and work on a farm to try to regain my health. It was one of my darkest hours. At that time, I was holding a series of meetings in Lucknow. While praying one night, an event happened that completely transformed my life. While in prayer, and I was not particularly thinking about myself at the time, a voice seemed to say, "Are you yourself ready for this work to which I have called you?" I replied, "No, Lord, I am done for I have reached the end of my resources." The voice replied, "If you will turn that over to me and not worry about it, I will take care of it." I quickly answered, "Lord, I close the bargain right here." A great peace settled into my heart and pervaded my whole being. I knew it was done. Life, abundant life, had taken possession of me. I was so lifted up that I scarcely touched the road as I quietly walked home that night. Every inch was holy ground. For days after that, I hardly knew I had a body. I went through the days working all day and far into the night, and came down to bedtime wondering why in the world I should ever go to bed at all, for there was not the slightest trace of tiredness of any kind. I seemed possessed by life and peace and rest, by Christ Himself. The question came as to whether I should tell this. I shrank from it, but felt I should, and did. After that, it was sink or swim before everybody. More than a score of the most strenuous years of my life have gone by since then, but the old trouble has never returned. I have never had such health. But it was more than a physical touch. I seem to have tapped new life for body, mind, and spirit. After that experience, life for me functioned on a permanently higher level, and I had done nothing but take it. During the many years that have gone by since then, I have traveled all over the world, frequently lecturing three times a day, and have found time and strength to write The Christ of the Indian Road and 11 other books. Yet in the midst of all this, I have never missed or even been late to an appointment. The worries that once beset me have long since vanished, and now in my 63rd year, I am overflowing with abounding vitality and the joy of serving and living for others. I suppose that the physical and mental transformation that I have experienced could be picked to pieces psychologically and explained. It does not matter. Life is bigger than processes and overflows and dwarfs them. This one thing I know. My life was completely transformed and uplifted that night in Lucknow 31 years ago when, at the depth of my weakness and depression, a voice said to me, "If you will turn that over to me and not worry about it, I will take care of it." And I replied, "Lord, I close the bargain right here." When the sheriff came in my front door, by Homer Croy. The biggest moment of my life occurred one day in 1933, when the sheriff came in the front door and I went out the back. I'd lost my home at 10 Standish Road, Forest Hills, Long Island, where my children were born, and where I and my family had lived for 18 years. I'd never dreamed that this could happen to me. 12 years before, I thought I was sitting on top of the world. I'd sold the motion picture rights to my novel, West of the Water Tower, for a top Hollywood price. I lived abroad with my family for 2 years. We summered in Switzerland and wintered on the French Riviera, just like the idle rich. I spent 6 months in Paris and wrote a novel entitled They Had to See Paris. Will Rogers appeared in the screen version. It was his first talking picture. I had tempting offers to remain in Hollywood and write several of Will Rogers' pictures, but I didn't. I returned to New York, and my troubles began. It slowly dawned on me that I had great dormant abilities that I'd never developed. I began to fancy myself a shrewd businessman. Somebody told me that John Jacob Astor had made millions investing in vacant land in New York. Who was Astor? Just an immigrant peddler with an accent. If he could do it, why couldn't I? I was going to be rich. I began to read the yachting magazines. I had the courage of ignorance. I didn't know any more about buying and selling real estate than an Eskimo knows about oil furnaces. How was I to get the money to launch myself on my spectacular financial career? Oh, that was simple. I mortgaged my home and bought some of the finest building lots in Forest Hills. I was going to hold on to this land until it reached a fabulous price and then sell it and live in luxury. I, who had never sold a piece of real estate as big as a doll's handkerchief. I pitied the plodders who slaved in offices for a mere salary. I told myself that God had not seen fit to touch every man with the divine fire of financial genius. Suddenly, the Great Depression swept down upon me like a Kansas cyclone and shook me as a tornado would shake a hencoop. I had to pour $220 a month into that monster-mouthed piece of good earth. Oh, how fast those months came! In addition, I had to keep up the payments on our now mortgaged house and find enough food. I was worried. I tried to write humor for the magazines. My attempt at humor sounded like the Lamentations of Jeremiah. I was unable to sell anything. The novels I wrote failed. I ran out of money. I had nothing on which I could borrow money except my typewriter and the gold fillings in my teeth. The milk company stopped delivering milk. The gas company turned off the gas. We had to buy one of those little outdoor camp stoves you see advertised. It had a cylinder of gasoline. You pump it up by hand, and it shoots out a flame with a hissing like an angry goose. We ran out of coal. The company sued us. Our only heat was the fireplace. I'd go out at night and pick up boards and leftovers from the new homes that the rich people were building. I, who had started out to be one of those rich people. I was so worried I couldn't sleep. I often got up in the middle of the night and walked for hours to exhaust myself so I could fall asleep. I lost not only the vacant land I had bought, but all my heart's blood that I had poured into it. The bank closed the mortgage on my home and put me and my family out on the street. In some way we managed to get hold of a few dollars and rent a small apartment. We moved in the last day of 1933. I sat down on a packing case and looked around. An old saying of my mother's came back, "Don't cry over spilt milk." But this wasn't milk, this was my heart's blood. After I sat there a while, I said to myself, "Well, I've hit bottom, and I've stood it. There is no place to go now but up." I began to think of the fine things that the mortgage had not taken from me. I still had my health and my friends. I would start again. I would not grieve about the past. I would repeat to myself every day the words I had often heard my mother say about spilt milk. I put into my work the energy that I'd been putting into worrying. Little by little, my situation began to improve. I am almost thankful now that I had to go through all that misery. It gave me strength, fortitude, and confidence. I know now what it means to hit bottom. I know it doesn't kill you. I know we can stand more than we think we can. When little worries and anxieties and uncertainties try to disturb me now, I banish them by reminding myself of the time I sat down in the packing case and said, I've hit bottom and I've stood it. There is no place to go now but up. What's the principle here? Don't try to saw sawdust. Accept the inevitable. If you can't go lower, you can try going up. The toughest opponent I ever fought was worry, by Jack Dempsey. During my career in the ring, I found that old man worry was an almost tougher opponent than the heavyweight boxers I fought. I realized that I had to learn to stop worrying, or worry would sap my vitality and undermine my success. So little by little, I worked out a system for myself. Now, here are some of the things I did. To keep up my courage in the ring, I'd give myself a pep talk during the fight. For example, while I was fighting Firpo, I kept saying over and over, "Nothing is going to stop me. He's not going to hurt me. I won't feel his blows. I can't get hurt. I'm going to keep going no matter what happens." Making positive statements like that to myself and thinking positive thoughts helped me a lot. It even kept my mind so occupied that I didn't feel the blows. During my career, I've had my lips smashed, my eyes cut, my ribs cracked. Firpo knocked me clear through the ropes, and I landed on a reporter's typewriter and wrecked it. But I never felt even one of Firpo's blows. There was only one blow that I ever really felt. That was the night Lester Johnson broke three of my ribs. The punch never hurt me, but it affected my breathing. Now, I can honestly say I never felt any other blow I ever got in the ring. Another thing I did was to keep reminding myself of the futility of worry. Most of my worrying was done before the big bouts while I was going through training. I'd often lie awake at night for hours, tossing and worrying, unable to sleep. I'd worry for fear I might break my hand or sprain my ankle or get my eye cut badly in the first round so I couldn't coordinate my punches. And when I got myself into this state of nerves, I used to get out of bed, look into the mirror, and give myself a good talking to. I'd say to myself, "What a fool you are to be worrying about something that hasn't happened and may never happen. Life is short. I have only a few years to live, so I must enjoy life." I kept saying to myself, "Nothing is important but my health. Nothing is important but my health." I kept reminding myself that losing sleep and worrying would destroy my health. I found that by saying these things to myself over and over, night after night, year after year, they finally got under my skin, and I could brush off my worries like so much water. The third and best thing I did was pray. And while I was training for a bout, I always prayed several times a day. When I was in the ring, I always prayed just before the bell sounded for each round. That helped me fight with courage and confidence. I've never gone to bed in my life without saying a prayer. I've never eaten a meal in my life without first thanking God for it, thousands of times. I Prayed to God to Keep Me Out of an Orphan's Home, by Kathleen Halter. As a little child, my life was filled with terror. My mother had heart trouble. Day after day, I saw her faint and fall to the floor. We all feared she was going to die, and I believed that all little girls whose mothers died were sent to the Central Wesleyan Orphan's Home, located in the little town of Warrenton, Missouri, where we lived. I dreaded the thought of going there, and when I was 6 years old, I prayed constantly, "Dear God, please let Mummy live until I am old enough not to go to the orphan's home." 20 years later, my brother Minor had a terrible injury and suffered intense pain until he died 2 years later. He couldn't feed himself or turn over in bed. To deaden his pain, I had to give him morphine hypodermics every 3 hours, day and night. I did this for 2 years.